I have to say, I like that new intro that God did. It's pretty cool, isn't it? Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Deepest Law. We're still doing our Adam Curtis season, although I have this show has been hit with various delays and illnesses in the past few weeks. Just about recovering today, just about, but I'm still basically coughing up large globules of phlegm. And I want that to stop because, frankly, it's gross. But anyway, we have reached 1992 and Pandora's Box. This is the first of Curtis's documentary series where it seems like he had full creative control. We're not quite there with his kind of definitive style. I think that comes in 1995 with the next series, which I think is called The Living Dead. But Pandora's Box, you know, he's narrating himself. I think everything is written by him. There's no kind of BBC kind of house style breathing down his neck as there has been with Oceans Apart and the last one that we looked at, which was about the Iranian Revolution. Today, we're going to be starting with episode one, which is the engineer's plot. But before we get there, I will just remind everybody, do buy my courses at the academic agency. I really did put a lot of work into those courses, and they take a lot of work to put together. I have, I'm planning to do a Shakespeare course. I think I might just call it Foundations of Shakespeare to, you know, stick with the the template. And the reason there's been such a delay on doing a Foundations of Shakespeare is because I've been hoping to find my old lectures, but I'm now of the mind that I should probably just rewrite all the lectures from scratch and have a brand new, i.e. have all of the material in my voice from now, as opposed to, you know, stuff I wrote 10, 15 years ago, which probably, you know, I wasn't as based back then as I am now. So I think, I think I'll redo all my lectures. I'm going to be starting on that soon. I thought by announcing it on this on this show, it would then commit me to actually doing it. It's taken me a while. I've been in a bit of a funk ever since February last year when my last book came out. I've just been busy and have three shows to do a week. I put out videos, and the biggest thing is having a three-year-old, now four-year-old, to look after, and having a family and so on. Demanding of one's time, but I think that I'm finally gonna, you know, try to hit the ground running once again, and I think maybe getting that Shakespeare course out may be the way to pull myself out of the funk, and then I might actually write Boomer Truth Regime. But anyway, that's enough thinking out loud. See, everybody says I'm productive, but in my mind, I've been running at 10% since last February, so, you know, I suppose this is the way you look at it. But anyway, the very first, given that this, the biggest selling course at the academic agency is the Trivium, and that's the one I recommend people start with. But there are other courses, and the very first course I wrote and produced was Foundations of Economics. And given that we're going to be talking about the economics of the Soviet Union on this stream. I actually think that the, you know, it's not a libertarian course. It's just a pure Austrian economics course, looking at, you know, what people might call mundane economics and price theory and things like that. And I actually think that revisiting that course or taking that course would be able to make you see in a stroke all of the problems and why the Soviet Union had so many of the problems it did. You know, they ran straight into Hayek's knowledge problem and the Ludwig von Mises calculation problem. And in fact, our economy, which is more centrally controlled than it appears even today, runs into a lot of these same problems. I think they've got technology and data and so on that can help them a little bit more than the tech they had back in the Soviet Union, but it doesn't actually circumvent the core problems, because I mean, it's not an ideological thing. You're dealing with you know, maths, basically. just you know, things that either make sense or don't. You're dealing with questions of ultimate causation, and that this is why I maintain that at its core Austrian economics is correct. Still, the trouble is that in the real world, politics will always take primacy over economics. So, you know, the dream of the Austrians of having the kind of, you know, the perfect equilibrium or something approaching it will, you know, in the end, end up becoming just as utopian as the communists. But anyway, for old time's sake, I'm going to play my Foundations of Economics advert. And when we come back, we're going to watch the entirety of the Engineer's Plot. I think the best way to do it would be like last time, where we watched the whole thing together with some commentary from me. I don't think there's any violence in this one, so I shouldn't get the 18 stamp. All right, Foundations of Economics. Buy it now. If I can find the advert. Where is it? Oh, here we are.
Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now.
All right, so let's make a start. This is Pandora's Box, Episode 1, The Engineer's Plot.
I used to come to the place where tomorrow meets today.
Ooh!
If you were a scientist, you were...
I just want to say, by the way, that quite apart from the content, I have always loved the archival style. I love the old archival footage. And it's one of the reasons I have a great love of Adam Curtis movies, because even if you ignore everything that he's saying and the political implications and the content, they're just great to look at. I've always loved archival stuff. And, you know, in the times I bothered to try to up my production values, it always, even when I try to be creative myself, it always kind of comes out as, you know, in this kind of style archival. So anyway, let's carry on. There's also a fascination that Curtis has with this little period just after World War II. I think it's basically from about 1945 to about, let's call it 1969. You could push it back a bit further, but I would say like landing on the moon is the ultimate endpoint of it, where there was this kind of strange utopian, almost sci-fi like optimism And a lot of stuff that we associate with sci-fi was also just there in the culture, and it was there in the imagination. And I he is fascinated with that period. And I think that there is also a fascination for all of us with that period, because we're seeing the kind of, there's like a nostalgia for the dreams of tomorrow from yesterday, even though we know that every single one of those utopian dreams, whether they were in the USSR or in the USA, were basically unrealized. They were all unrealized, really. But they had hope and optimism after World War II. All right, let's carry on.
To those who began the revolution in Russia 75 years ago, science was a grand liberating force. They believed Karl Marx had discovered the scientific laws of society, which they would now use to unlock the gates to a new world, where everyone would be equal and free. But within 20 years, the revolution was taken over by technocrats who looked down on the crowd below as though they were atoms.
Much like our leaders today.
They were inspired not by Marx, but by the laws of engineering. They believed they could transform the Soviet Union into a giant rational machine, which they would run for their political masters.
Много людей, они по-разному одеты, они по-разному выглядят, но все же каждый из этих людей, которые идут, они агрегируются в какие-то социальные группы. Видите, в обществе действует совершенно объективные законы. Так же, как и в природе, в физике, в механике. И уж так хотелось сделать людей счастливыми. Так хотелось сделать их, ну, если не богатыми, то достаточно.
So it's interesting, actually, that the Soviet chap there, he actually recognized something that our elites today don't admit. I think they do recognize it privately, which is that fundamentally people aren't atoms, they're part of groups which have, I mean, I basically agree with the statement he just made there. Probably he had different groups in mind than the groups that I've got in mind, but it's not a bad insight, to be honest. Made in 1992. Trap in the chat, who just asked. It's 1992. Come on,
this is a story of science and political power. How the Bolsheviks' vision of using science to change the world was itself transformed. What resulted was a strange experiment, far removed from the original aims of the revolution.
Greetings from Moscow, the capital of the Soviet Union, the world's first socialist state, in which everything belongs to the people, everything is created by the people, and everything is done to benefit the people.
From the beginning of the revolution, modern technology was central to the Bolsheviks' plans. Above all, the new power of electricity. In 1920, Lenin unveiled in the Kremlin a huge map studded with light bulbs to show the...
I just want to say something here, which is that, you know, as awful as the USSR and the Soviet Union turned out to be, I still find it absolutely fascinating that this live human experiment took place at such a great scale and had such a huge impact on the world. It's fascinating, it really is. And to be fair, that is also true of America, which is also a kind of grand, in my view, failed experiment. But it's just fascinating that these things happened, you know. Anyway, let's carry on.
Planned electrification of the country. To illuminate the bulbs, all electricity in the rest of Moscow had to be shut off.
Идея была простая. Он был интересен не просто тем, что будут строить заводы, фабрики, электростанции. Идея была такая – и создать нового человека. Вот этим действительно план ГУЛРО отличался от любого другого, который разрабатывались до этого времени.
Communism, said Lenin, is Soviet power plus electrification. The aim of the Bolsheviks was to transform the people they ruled into what they called scientific beings, people able to understand and control the machines of the modern world rather than become enslaved by them. They organized mass parades where the machines symbolically crushed the irrational dogmas of the past. Moscow became what Lenin called a talking city, its walls adorned with geometric perspectives, giving glimpses of a new rational world. Its statues surrounded by parallelograms and futuristic structures. Even music was used to transform the way people understood the world. Electrical machines made what was called rational music.
It's just absolutely fascinating. Can you imagine being the dislocated peasant in 1925 or something? Must have been the... What the hell's going on? Amazing, really is.
The most extraordinary project of all was the Central Institute of Labour, set up on Lenin's orders. It was run by Alexei Gastev, who photographed and studied workers as though they were parts in a machine. It was far more than mere time and motion. Gastev believed he could teach people to think and behave in a rational way. To do this, he built the social engineering machine, a giant structure of pulleys, cogs, and weights. How it worked is today a mystery, even to his son.
В Центральном институте труда была построена так называемая социальная инженерная машина. Социальная инженерия, я думаю, что это учет учет коротких путей, как вот он искал. В этом вот какой-то кратчайший и максимально эффективный путь. Так можно и государство выучивать, так же, как вот обучается этот человек. То есть государство можно научить управлять так же, как любой другой машиной. И вот эта социальная инженерная машина, она должна быть установлена всюду. Заставить работать новое общество настолько эффективно, насколько оно в состоянии. Вот это и есть задача социальной инженерной машины, если понимать человека тоже как часть этой социальной инженерной машины, разумную часть.
Such is the power of science, said Trotsky, that the average human being will become an Aristotle, a Goethe, a Marx, and beyond this, new peaks will rise. In fact, the power to shape the future of the Soviet Union was passing to those who could build the new industrial society that the Bolsheviks wanted so much.
Yeah, I mean, it stands to reason that in something where you're trying to socially and rationally plan the whole society, that the power would then be vested in the people who do that planning. Managerial control, essentially. It becomes a hard managerialism, as we'll see, but... This is a point that was made by Burnham and others.
They were known as the bourgeois specialists, engineers from before the revolution who had the skills needed to master the modern technology. Many had actually opposed the revolution, but by 1923, they made up over three quarters of the powerful state planning committee. Under the Tsar, their plans for factories and power stations had remained on the drawing board. Now they were being given the chance to...
And this is something I've tried to stress to people over and over again, is that it doesn't matter if people support or oppose something at the time, they will, once power is established, become part of the new power structure. This is why I've tried to, like, let's pretend there's like a base revolution or something. Unless you do like an all-out purge, many of the people who call themselves left-wing and woke now would just change their hat, they change their uniform, and they become... This is something else I find absolutely fascinating all through history. But, I've talked about Vichy France before, where literally the same people have served under three different regimes before the war, during the war, and after the war. Same in Russia.
Build them, and they became influential figures.
У нас в ту пору были крупные инженеры, специалисты, энергетики, которые, пользуясь у нас значительным уважением, это те, которые строили электростанции. Старые специалисты, мы их высоко ценили. Такие широкие массы людей, они не все знали, что такое электричество. Но они ощущали, что это дает дорогу для новой жизни.
So one of the things that I was, when I was younger, I kind of coped and resisted that, you know, one of the problems, I guess, with Soviet thinking was that everybody's an individual, that, you know, at some level, there'd be a kind of, you know, everybody needs to find their own way or whatever. This was the liberal, this was kind of liberalism within myself. Actually, as you're seeing here, regardless of whether they, you know, succeeded ultimately in the USSR, you can see that the peasantry and the bulk of the population did basically do as they were told, and they did conform to the new vision that was imposed on them by the elites in a way that was almost total, you know, should be a lesson, really, because this, all of this stuff actually happened. So let's carry on.
Lenin saw how his dream of control over this new technical world was slipping away. To tell the truth, he said, the communists are not directing anything. They are being directed.
Yes. Top down.
But in 1924, Lenin died. After a bitter struggle, Stalin seized power. He was determined to recapture the momentum of the revolution. To do so, he decided to send Russia on a crash course of industrialization. It would bring even more power to the bourgeois engineers.
Now, this, what we're going to look at, is one of the marvels of world history, in my opinion. And I still struggle to get my head around how it was that Stalin killed so many people and Russia lost so many people, yet the population grew and they did achieve full industrialization. I mean, it is truly almost miraculous. And this is one of those things I think about often. You know, obviously Stalin is very vilified in history for understandable reasons. And of course by America, who is, you know, one of their big opponents, the Cold War and so on. But the fact is this did happen and they did achieve industrialization in Russia. So this is something I think about often, actually. I remain absolutely fascinated by it. And as time has gone on, I want to say, like, I kind of respect or appreciate Stalin, because obviously he was an evil bastard, but I am kind of curious as to how he managed to pull off what he did. Don't forget, in the middle of it, they had a massive world war as well, which they won as well. I mean, they not only won World War II, but did it at a time where they were basically like doing a quantum leap, like a kind of two-step quantum leap in, you know, quote-unquote progress. So you can't really take that away from them. And that's probably why Stalin is fondly remembered by many Russians today, because, you know, he may have been a bastard, but look at what he achieved. Look at the outcome. And he died in power, too. He died in power, which isn't something that not many modern leaders can say.
Так вот, мы остановились там, сели в поезд, я пассажирском и товарном вагоне. Мы ехали ровно 7 дней с Москвы до Магнитки. 7 дней. Народу тысячи ехало.
In 1927, Stalin began the five-year plan. Hundreds of thousands of volunteers travelled to the remote and desolate parts of the Soviet Union. Millions more were forced off the land at gunpoint to join them. They had 5 years, Stalin told them, to build a modern industrial state.
You see, I don't want to keep on interrupting it too much. you know, I will let it play longer, but there's so many things that are coming to mind as I'm watching this. And as some of you know, around Christmas time and just a bit after, I bought all these books about ancient civilizations and, you know, huge books on world history and so on. And, you know, obviously I haven't read them all, but I've certainly browsed and read key sections and things like that. And one of the things that really interests me all through history is that the steppes, these great, huge swathes of land all across, you know, what is today the Russian Empire and what was then the USSR, you know, stretching all the way over into Mongolia and, you know, just to the west of China. And these are always described in history as just these kind of great, vast wastelands. There's like bugger all there. They're never like, they never build cities there or anything. And there's something so stark about the actual landmass that the Russians hold. You know, that you've got the great wastes of Siberia, but then you've got all those steppes and all those plains and all those mountains. And it's a really harsh, stark bit of land. And it's, you know, I mean, it's huge landmass. All the, you know, Russia is still the biggest country in the world. And something about the fact that this happens in that kind of wilderness as well, I find really fascinating. It's something that, because no civilization, whether it's the Chinese or any of the historical powers, was ever really able to tame all of that. It just kind of, I mean, even to this day, huge swathes of it are just nothing. Like most of Western China is still basically nothing. Like where the Uyghur Muslims live. I mean, there's fuck all there, basically. But anyway, let's carry on.
Приехали в Магнитку, сошли с поезда, шли пешком до завода управления. Мы пришли, подали бумагу, нам говорят, идите прямо в цех. Нам, значит, погрузили ведра, будильники в ведра, чтобы не просыпали. Давай, ребят, не утекайте, не уезжайте. Магнитка будет одна из промышленных городов. Все будет. А степ одна.
Magnitogorsk, built in the far-off Ural Mountains on the edge of Asia, was to become one of the largest steel plants in the world. At the center of these gigantic projects were the only engineers the Soviet Union possessed, the bourgeois specialists.
Разные инженеры шли на то, чтобы быть организаторами и руководителями великих строек. Конечно, они продавали свободу свою. То есть им сначала это не представлялось. Напротив, им казалось, что перед ними открываются неслыханные горизонты свободы творчества. Никто из них не знал, что их великие планы обернутся тем, что те, которые с энтузиазмом восстанавливали наше хозяйство, сядут на скамью подсудимых и будут обвиняться во вредительстве.
At the end of 1930, the engineer's dream suddenly became a nightmare. Stalin ordered 2,000 of them to be arrested, and 8 of the most senior were put on a public show trial. The charges were fantastic. The prosecutor alleged that the bourgeois engineers were leaders of a political organization, the Industrial Party.
I mean, the thing is that you have to understand what's happening mechanically here. The engineers, in Juvenalian terms, were newly elevated bureaucrats, okay? And their power by 1930 was getting to the point where they were becoming a rival castle to the Politburo, controlled by Stalin. Stalin, a keen observer of power, could not tolerate. Power cannot tolerate the rival castle. So, of course, he had to eliminate them. And Stalin's regime being hard managerial, a lion regime as opposed to a fox regime, basically, you know, used brutality to in order to do that, not persuasion. Our regime would use soft persuasion, gay little techniques, or put financial pressure on them and or just fire them and ruin their lives or whatever. But Stalin, he's going to kill them all. So,
and had plotted to seize power. Their government would have been composed solely of technical specialists and scientists. Their confessions were carefully rehearsed. But behind this public charade was a very real struggle. Stalin, like Lenin before him, had come to realize that with technology came power. A year before, a group of these engineers had publicly challenged him to give them more control of the five-year plan. The future they had announced belongs to managing engineers. Instead, they were led away from the cameras, condemned to death, or to continue to work on their schemes in chains. A week later, Stalin announced, "Bolsheviks must master technology. It is time for the Bolsheviks themselves to become specialists."
And there's, you see, the thing is that once you understand these mechanisms, we'll be talking next week about people like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel now. I mean, in a way, their position vis-a-vis the regime is similar to these engineers that you're seeing in 1930. The regime is Stalin. And, you know, it can go either way. Like, if history didn't have to play out this way. If Stalin was less paranoid and less of a kind of control freak, they could have taken over the Soviet Union. But they didn't. Stalin was onto them, basically. But it can go a different way.
In the Reconstruction period, technology decides everything. He ordered engineering schools to be set up across the country to train thousands of the young party faithful. But in the process, the aim of the revolution was redefined. 10 years before, technology was to have been a radiant means of liberating millions of people. Now it had become an end in itself. For these young Red experts, it was simply large-scale industrial production.
You see, as brutal as all of this is, I do think there's a grandeur and a heroism in it and a kind of masculinity in what they were doing. You know, in hard steel, you know, there's something about that kind of hard industrialism that does have its own kind of terrifying romance, I think. And I feel like there's a way of seeing it in that way. You know, you can see the heroic in it as well, I think. You know, anyway, let's carry on.
Выросла и большая плеяда инженеров. Счет шел уже на сотни тысяч. Надо признать, что все-таки это были люди, которые смотрели на общество как на механизм. Именно как механизм. У них и терминология сплошь и рядом была по Сталину. Человек это... Значит, если мы внимательно посмотрим на психологию этих людей, они искренне считали, что именно с помощью техники этот механизм можно быстро двинуть вперед. А реально, на самом деле, получалось другое. Росли заводы, фабрики, новые предприятия. Они нуждались в новых инженерах. И получился странный процесс. Инженеры создают новых инженеров. У нас сейчас в стране готовят инженеров даже сейчас. Больше, чем в любой стране мира.
And this is an aspect of Russia that has not changed, by the way. I was looking at stats the other day, and Russia produces more engineers per capita than pretty much any other country. They have got double, despite having a population that is almost half of that of America, they produce double the number of engineers, something like 492,000 engineers to this day. The Iranians are also obsessed by engineers, by the way. My dad is an engineer, incidentally. like in that society, you know, in Iran, they see being an engineer a bit like being a doctor or something. It's got kind of like respect attached to it and things like that. But I think the Russians are the same. And I feel that this is still in their, ingrained in their kind of culture and their thinking, the exalted place of the engineer. Engineers were big in this country once during the 19th century. I feel they're not as exalted as they should be. You know, it's kind of given way now, isn't it? To the kind of tech nerds and people like this. These are the engineers of today. But anyway, let's carry on.
The education the engineers received was of the narrowest kind. Lunacharsky, the Commissar of Education, pleaded with Stalin. There is a certain minimum of general scientific culture, he said, which an engineer must master and which we cannot dispense with. It is as if discovering that it is possible to live with four fingers, we have decided to cut off the fifth one. But he was dismissed. The model for this new simplified world was America, the most successful industrial state in the world. Stalin was determined to overtake it. The prototype was Magnitogorsk, which had been based on a particular American city.
We invite you to a city which has the largest steelworks, the largest tin plant in the world. We invite you to a city of blazing furnaces, of handsome homes, of magnificent schools, of splendid churches, of towering hotels and fraternal temples, of shining beaches, of restful dunes, of winding drives of flashing water and dazzling sands. This is the city that we invite you, and truthfully, it is called the Magic City. Called the Magic City for these reasons.
Like many cities in America's Northeast, Gary, Indiana is now almost derelict. But 70 years ago, it was a new kind of model city, planned in an ordered way around a giant steel mill. To its builders, it was a chance to break with the complexities of the past.
What happened to Gary, Indiana? That'd be an interesting question to go into. But, this is something else that is fascinating to Curtis. It's one of his obsessions. Parallels between America and the USSR. Also of interest, of course, to James Burnham and people like that. But, you know, the extent to which the USA and USSR were parallels and mirrors to each other, and the extent to which they have had a symbiotic relationship, I think, is something, and almost a dialectical relationship vis-a-vis each other, is something that I think is difficult to understand today. Although, with Putin, it's kind of coming back in a way, because Russia is the permanent enemy now. But I feel like our leaders don't really pay attention to what the Russians are doing, and they don't try to compete in the same way that they did before. But Russia, I mean, I talked before about how the civil rights regime and the stuff, you know, stuff around abolishing racism and so on, a lot of it was driven by competition and critiques coming from Russia, coming from the USSR. And, you know, the extent to which the two rivals saw themselves in competition with each other and tried to outdo each other also makes them weirdly the same. And that is something that fascinates me. I hope to somehow talk about that in Boomer Truth Regime, but I don't know how I'm going to talk about it yet. But anyway, let's carry on.
We were building that city, and we took pride in that. We started fresh. We didn't have to undo anything. See, and we picked out what was the best all over, even the steel mills. We didn't have to destroy something to put something better in. We started with something better right along. We got the best out of the catalogs that were available. Those were some of the things. It was a magic city. There was a magic in doing this thing. You took pride in something like that. They were all building the new world.
Magnitogorsk was a copy of Gary. These plans for the works, with the city radiating out from beyond, were drawn up by the same American designers who built Gary. Inspired by one of the most ambitious construction projects in the world, some American engineers even came to Magnitogorsk to take part in the building of Russia's City of Steel.
We were always at war with Gary, Indiana.
Мечты у нас, конечно, были очень высокие. Мечтали о том, что здесь будет прекрасный город, что наш город будет походить на американские города. И мечта, конечно, прежде всего представлялась в дворцах, в домах хороших, в парках. Вот у нас там был очень прекрасный парк разбит рабочими. Первое дерево рассказывает, что было просто металлическим. Отлиты вот эти ветки из металла, поскольку там была степь, ни одного дерева не было. И мечтой, и воплощением в делах, которые люди делали. Мы в это очень верили, но я надеюсь, что мы не ошиблись.
Wonder if that Russian town is still there and if his industry is still intact. You know, the copy of Gary, Indiana. I wonder, I'd be interested to know.
As in Gary, a planned city began to grow up around the plant. But in a quiet valley nearby, a very different city was constructed, where the American engineers lived.
Designed by a young Russian architect named Saprykin. These dozen large houses were copied almost exactly from American architectural...
It's fucking fascinating, isn't it? Look, they built an American-style little suburban town for the engineers to live in. Isn't that amazing?
...catalogs. The result was something very much approaching Mount Vernon, New York, or Germantown, Pennsylvania. And what everyone called the American city... The atmosphere of a summer evening held a suspicion of the smugness of Park Avenue. Yet less than 2 miles away, the wolves howled, and the wind blew across the endless Russian steppe.
Когда вот мы приходили на березки, завалась такая мелодичная там песня, музыка, как будто в другой мир мы входили.
Those who lived in the American city were the new elite, a mixture of old Bolshevik commissars, foreign technicians, and an ever-increasing number of young red engineers. By the mid-30s, the engineers had become the heroes in Soviet society. Praised by Stalin, they flaunted their new status, relaxing in the shadow of the modern industrial world they had built for him. Soviet man, who was once to have surpassed Aristotle, Goethe, and Marx, had been replaced by the image of a zealous engineer taught to think of everything in technical terms and completely loyal to Stalin. In the 30s, thousands traveled to the Soviet Union to marvel at this dream come true. But what they saw was not communism. Instead, it was an orderly society administered by technocrats. George Bernard Shaw, like many other fellow travellers, made it clear that what he admired was the benevolent despotism of these enlightened technicians.
Benevolent despotism of enlightened technicians. Very interesting, eh, friends? Very interesting.
In Russia, he said, the leaders have been scientifically educated for their job.
Hello, good evening, everybody. This is Moscow calling.
The counter-revolutionary Trotsky wrecking group in the Kemerovo mines is over. The proletarian corps and no Trotsky's reptiles and their foreign protectors are able to undermine the might of our...
In 1937, Stalin began another series of purges.
Death to the enemies of the people.
This time, his targets were the tens of thousands of old Bolsheviks. Once he had fought the revolution with them, now they ran the country as commissars and plant directors.
Got to eliminate those rival castles, see? These purges were absolutely necessary for Stalin to consolidate his power. You know, always remember that film Carlito's Way. Billy Blanco from the Bronx and Al Pacino. He's got a chance to kill him and he doesn't. And the film ends with Billy Blanco from the Bronx killing Al Pacino. And Stalin, being an astute observer of power, understood that more than anyone. So, of course, he had to do it. Of course he did.
In a notorious wave of show trials, Stalin destroyed them.
The purge struck Magnitogorsk with great force. No group, nobody in the works was spared.
Ну, тогда было количество такое, что специалистов, авторитетов, туда-сюда сажать. Значит, у нас был директор завода Завинягина Абрам Павлович. Вот. А начальником доме цех Корбу Павел Иванович звонит Завинягину. Абрам Павлович тогда говорит, что старые специалисты уезжают. Да, тот Абрам Павлович звонит. Павел Иванович, а тебе же едут специалисты, въезжают, чем ты остаешься? Он говорит, я остаюсь с молодежью. Будут молодые кадры работать. Отпускаете, всех подпустили. Осталась одна молодежь.
This is also bad, though, because it introduces some bio-Leninism. And this is where ultimately where the whole idea of bio-Leninism comes from, is that the each time you do one of these purges, you lose the technical skills and, you know, you replace people who are good at their jobs with loyalists to the regime. This is basically like a soft version of it. Because we live in a soft kind of gay persuasion, Fox-based regime, all of this stuff happens without the bloodshed, but it still happens. And watching things like this can kind of help you see the raw mechanics of power that I talk about in Populist Delusion, for example.
Он был арестован в 1938 году. В 1939 его судили и расстреляли. Это было довольно... Вот социальная инженерная машина могла бы это предсказать, что надвигается какая-то колоссальная растрата, понимаете? Вот как человек, заведующий складом, задумал что-то уничтожить, так и тут надвигалась вот социальная инженерная машина. Я могу себе представить, как она нервничает, как она... Чувствую, что что-то тут такое происходит, что-то получается, что-то чудовищное. Но, к сожалению, некому было воспрепятствовать этому. Это так и произошло.
The beneficiaries of these purges were Stalin's Red Engineers. As the 30s drew to a close, they were in charge throughout Soviet industry. Among them were young men like Leonid Brezhnev, Alexei Kosygin, and Nikita Khrushchev. Unlike their predecessors, the bourgeois engineers, they were completely unquestioning of Stalin's political aims. Their narrow, specialist training now led them to approach the task of planning the Soviet Union as though it were a piece of engineering. There would be technical solutions to everything. The war seemed to prove the engineers right. It was their organization of the industrial plants that ultimately saved Russia from the Nazis. Victory left large parts of the country utterly destroyed. Those now in charge were convinced that to rebuild the Soviet Union, an all-embracing plan would be needed, one in which everything would be taken care of in a rational way.
See, what one of the things that fascinates me is that although I understand the drawbacks and the inefficiencies of rationalistic top-down planning, you can achieve quite a lot just through top-down pressure and force, just through ultimate political organization and control. And they did. I mean, whichever way you look at it, they did achieve a lot. But we'll see the wheels come up. The wheels do come off because they run into hard problems of mathematics, as we'll see. But you can achieve a lot. I mean, you can't. I mean, they defeated Hitler. And they were against a fanatical, well-trained, ingenious, loyal army fighting for the fatherland. Who had a almost like divine, you know, they saw themselves almost having a divine mission. And yet the cold, rationalistic planet ultimately won out. So, you know.
It was a vision of a planned utopia. Everything in the new Russia was to be designed and controlled from the centre of Moscow. As the women sing of the future, they march past the giant headquarters of this organised society. Госплан, state plan.
Сюда, в Госплан, стекается информация со всей страны, и не только...
You know, this will be an unpopular point, but, you know, I think in the Western imagination, we always think about Soviet Union as miserable and as despotic and as brutal and all the rest of it. But I bet you there were people who were part of all that that we just saw, who genuinely did tap into that feeling of being part of something bigger than themselves and having a shared project. And of genuinely having, you know, an actual society, an actual community. You know, they definitely achieved more of that than modern Western countries today have, for example. That much is obvious. You can just see it, you know. And they didn't have many of the problems that we think about today. They just didn't have them because it was you can see the footage for yourself. We're now going to watch the wheels come off, but I do think it's important to try to be objective when you're looking at these things and not just kind of engage in, you know, Cold War era propaganda or, you know, seeing something as totally bad or totally good or whatever. So, there are good points achieved as well as bad points achieved. And many of the methods that they use in the Soviet in the mid-century Germany have kind of analogs with this. There was a lot of top-down control in the Mustache Man's regime as well, and you know they influence each other too, Hitler and Stalin. Curtis hasn't gone into it, but one of the things that Stalin had to do during the war years and during this little period that we're looking at here, is he had to appeal to a sense of nationalism and a sense of Russianness and things like that, because ultimately people are going to fight wars for that as opposed to, you know, communism or whatever. So, but anyway, let's carry on.
Хозяйственная или техническая информация. Это информация о состоянии общества, социальная информация. Это и вот со всей нашей огромной страны эта информация стекается сюда. Вот комнаты, где работает наш отдел. Я открою одну комнату, посмотрим. Вот товарищи сидят, работают. Они на нас не очень обращают внимание, заняты своим делом. Я должен сказать, что вот по тому пути информации, которая у нас в Госплане имеется, в конечном счете самые агрегированные, самые конечные цифры информации поступают в этот подотдел. Когда сформировался план, оно потом превращается в целый поток, в дождь информации, доходящей до каждого работника, и который определяет.
Now, the thing is, it's easy to mock all of this, but I've been to Google's offices in London, where every decision is meant to be data-driven, and they've got these massive screens up everywhere showing, like, live data, you know, everywhere. And our regime, the one that we've lived under all our lives, is obsessed with the idea of data and big data and data analytics and data, you know. So, I mean, is what they were doing so much different? You know, they didn't have the computers that we have today, but it's basically the same principle. It's the same principle.
Работу всех отраслей.
Госплан's managers built a world that was simple, like a machine. Everything society needed, down to the smallest object, was constructed to their design. Their instructions were called planned indicators, rational predictions of what they knew society needed.
Мы представляем Московское производственное объединение по выпуску пластмассовых изделий. Я генеральный директор, это мой заместитель по качеству. Мы выпускаем очень много щеточных изделий. Зубной щетки мы выпускаем 70 миллионов, что хватает для всего населения Советского Союза. Раньше работать было очень сложно, потому что до объединения доводилась очень большая масса различного рода показателей. Например, щетки планировались поштучно, также планировались и другие изделия.
I still think, by the way, that although the Misesian calculation problem is ultimately correct, ultimately logically correct, I think people underrate the extent to which this is how a lot of production is done today. I used to argue a lot with Lord Keynes too, but you know, in my various rebuttals to him, I learned a lot about the amount of rational calculation that goes into kind of corporate level decisions. And a lot of, like, let's just pretend Colgate, the toothpaste manufacturer, right? They have pretty predictable data sets, right? They've got like years and years of year-on-year toothbrush sales. Right, they know there are this amount of people in the country, this amount of people will probably buy the Colgate toothbrush, and they've got the production capacity to, you know, fulfill ultimately what is a pretty flat demand curve. Now, obviously not all products are like that, but a huge amount of products are like that. I've got an account at Statistica, and one of the things that I do sometimes, I go on that statistical account and I just whack in a product. Fairy Liquid is an example. And I look at historical year-on-year unit sales in thousands, month-on-month, for Fairy Liquid. And they're basically like unmoving. It's the same, like, okay, it might shift tiny, like 2%, 3% every year, but basically it's the same. and loads of products are like that. So, you know, you do run into the Misesian calculation problem, ultimately, as we'll see. But there's also a lot you can do just with some pretty, pretty basic maths, to be honest. Anyway, let's carry on.
Самые мелкие детали изготовления щеток контролируется государственными организациями, Государственным комитетом по статистике, районными комитетами партии, вот, в том числе, сколько щеток...
For Americans, Fairy Liquid is a washing up liquid, you know, to wash the dishes, you put on your sponge, you put on the plate and you know... There's always a debate. Do you put the Fairy Liquid on the sponge and clean the plate, or do you put it on the plate and clean it with the... I don't know. I mix and match. Some people, Mrs. AA, for example, she fills up the bowl of and does them all in one kind of soapy water. I hate that style. I've always been a running tap water individual dish guy, whereas she's always been a fill up the sink guy. But anyway, I use Fairy Liquid, so I'm one of those predictable data nodes. You know, I probably buy, what, 4 or 5 bottles a year. And they know that. They've got data on it going back to since the year I was born.
Каждой модели надо сделать предприятию.
One wants to get a view from all sides of this beautiful structure, which the Soviet people call the Palace of Science.
By the early 50s, vast reconstruction projects had changed the face of Soviet cities. Rationing ended 6 years earlier than in Britain. The Soviet Union was now an advanced industrial society.
Do you hear that? They lost 27 million people in World War II. 27 million. And they still ended rationing 6 years before the United Kingdom. Got to give them their due.
It was the golden age of the plan. But in its grandeur, the sweep of its ambitions, lay the seeds of its downfall.
Сама по себе идея плана – это не абсурдная идея. Но составление государственных планов и распределение всех сфер жизни только по государственным планам – это уже начинается абсурд. Во времена Берии, который возглавлял органы госбезопасности, органы НКВД, планировали даже количество людей, которые надо арестовать, переселить с одного места на другое. Заранее твердо говорилось, какой процент, сколько людей, куда. Планировалось даже, сколько нужно гробов, планировалось, сколько нужно романов, планировалось, сколько нужно кинофильмов. И дело доходило до абсурда.
Years the world has been dominated by the malignant power of Stalin. Now Stalin is dead and he cannot bequeath to anyone his prestige. A new era begins.
When Stalin died, much of the machinery of terror disappeared. The planned economy flourished, but as it did so, strange things began to happen. Planners discovered that what seemed rational to them could lead to the oddest behaviour.
So, the moment Stalin died, the system stopped working properly. That's what I'm hearing. I don't know if that's what you heard. That's what I heard. The moment that the great man of history died, things started going to shit. Interesting that.
Whole trainloads of output travelled thousands of miles for no reason, simply to fulfill a plan that measured success in tons carried per kilometre. Folk tales about the plan began to circulate.
План есть план. Он нас уже по боку бьет, этот план. Вот. Значит, счетчик накручивает. Это для того, чтобы план большой. Километраж нужно выполнить. Если километраж больше сделаешь, там 400-500 километров, значит, тебя наказывают. И вот для того, чтобы этот план выполнить и укладываться в определенный километраж, некоторые люди двигатель подставляют и обратно накручивают спидометр.
Mental. It's a really good film, by the way, The Death of Stalin. Shows some of the absurdity around that time. So...
Nikita Khrushchev, 1931 graduate from the Moscow Industrial Academy, understood the problem. It was the growing complexity of Soviet society. What had made it manageable was not scientific planning, but Stalin's brutal terror.
Yes. And if you take foundations of economics, I explain a lot of it in there, but the basic problem is that at a level of abstraction and complexity, let's say you've got a production process that's got, I don't know, literally like 57 different inputs in there. In a capitalistic society, each one of those inputs has a price signal, right? And you can follow just the pure price signal in order to allocate kind of resources and figure out pricing. If you're trying to plan all of that rationally, you literally just don't have you couldn't figure it out even if you wanted to, because let's pretend that you've got a set of prices for those 57 inputs today. Each one of those faces a shifting demand curve, basically. So Mises argues that even if you had perfect data, even if you have absolutely perfect data, the price shifts in real time all the time. And also the tastes of the public or the demands of the public shift all the time. So you're left with a problem because the data is always already completely out of date. So your plan, your rationalistic plan, is already out of kilter with what the economy needs at any given time. And this is the Misesian calculation problem. There is also the Hayekian knowledge problem, which relates to the amount of information that is stored in the price signal itself. So much stuff, like I don't know, there's a storm somewhere, or I don't know, there's been a fire and it's burnt down a forest. This is going to affect the price of wood, because, and you know all of that because the price signal tells you, oh, wood's more expensive, something's happened to the supply of wood, or more people need wood or something. So you can adjust your decisions based on those prices. But of course, if you're trying to plan everything top down like this, you run into those two problems. So on this score, Mises and Hayek are 100% correct, basically, that this is why the wheel started to come off on this. All right, let's carry on.
Khrushchev's dilemma was how to change the plan and the thinking of those who made it.
Вот, кстати, у вас план. Проезжаем. Вот он. У вас план. Вот там заседают.
Откуда? To be clear for the guy speaking in the chat, Mises did not say you could ever actually achieve perfect data. He is saying that even if you had perfect data at any given time, that data is almost always yesterday's set of prices. So by the time you've actually got them and produced that data, the actual real information and the actual real demand in the economy have already changed. So by the time you implement your five-year plan or whatever, the amount of whatever it is required, taxi drivers, toothbrushes, you know, the price of a screw. I mean, think of the amazing and mind-boggling complexity in a modern economy. All of those things are already out of date. So how on earth are you going to be able to figure out the correct amount of screws you need, how many machines you need to make those screws, et cetera. Whereas a capitalistic economy can basically deal with all of those things on the fly, because each individual node in the system only has to care about that one thing. You know, if you have a look at a modern supply chain, you know, in our economy even, there is a lot of central planning, don't get me wrong, but there's still nobody who has to think about the mind-boggling complexity of all of the bits in the chain. The guy who makes the screws only has to think about, you know, the supply and demand of the screws. And the guy who needs those screws for his wherever it happens to be, he only has to respond to the price point of that screw. So, you know, it's just a better way of doing it, basically. But anyway, let's carry on.
Они берут такие планы, я не знаю. Если их посадить на наше место, они бы, наверное, подумали головой, откуда брать такие планы.
Вот тоже наша комната. Вот здесь нет никого, знаешь, где-то на совещании. Тоже такое бывает, да?
In 1957, Khrushchev attacked the planning bureaucracy publicly. He made a speech that laid bare the growing absurdities in Soviet life. Why, he asked, were sofas getting bigger and bigger? Why were the metal chandeliers that hung from the Kremlin ceilings and everywhere else in Russia so heavy that they threatened to come crashing down?
And there was always stories about these actually falling down and like crushing people and things like that as well.
The reason, he said, was the planner's method of assessing the plan. The more metal, the more wood the factories used, the better the plan was working. As part of a whole series of reforms, Khrushchev insisted that the bureaucrats must begin to take into account the price of things.
Всегда. На всю номенклатуру продукции цены устанавливались не непосредственно предприятиями, а государственными службами. По существу, на всю номенклатуру выпускаемой продукции, а ее номенклатура исчисляется примерно 25 миллионов наименований, цены утверждают в Советском Союзе органы ценообразования.
That massive book of stats that you just saw is, literally, they were speed running the Misesian calculation problem and Hayek's knowledge problem, and that they're going to constantly run into the raw reality of what Mises and Hayek were saying. And again, this is not like a libertarian or capitalist versus socialist. It's just like a raw fact that there's just no way that any human being, no matter how smart they were, could basically deal with the sheer amount of moving parts and complexity that all of those different prices would require at any given time. It's just impossible. And this is why you're starting to see these kind of almost surreal and absurd things happening in Khrushchev era USSR.
Численность сотрудников нашего комитета примерно 400 человек, высококвалифицированных экспертов, которые проводят всю эту работу, которые включаются вот в многочисленные прескуранты. Это далеко не полный объем прескурантов. Эту стопу можно было бы еще увеличить примерно в два раза. Мне кажется, что это является ярким свидетельством того, что такая система рациональна. Безусловно, вот эта вот система цен, она сегодня очень громоздка. И внедрение...
And one of the things that I'll mention is that the current regime is running into very similar problems now. I actually took a clip of this and posted it under a Paul Krugman quote the other day, right, on Twitter. Paul Krugman was posting on Twitter, basically calling Americans stupid for not understanding that there isn't inflation in the economy. And everybody was saying, like, Paul, what the hell are you on about? I go to the grocery store every day and I'm paying $5 for a loaf of bread, mate. What are you talking about? And he is literally, Krugman is the modern day equivalent of this guy with his book saying, no, if you have a look at the official data, there's, you know, across, the CPI index shows that there's not inflation. There's not inflation. That's what Paul Krugman is trying to tell Americans today. And you've got people in the real economy saying, mate, whatever calculations you've got, this is not my experience of living in this economy. You know, I haven't had a pay rise in 3 years, but the price of bread is four times what it was 4 years ago. So what you're telling me, Professor Krugman? So it's actually interesting that the regime, even though it has this kind of weird quasi Keynesian, you know, Taleb calls it Soviet Harvard managerialism at the top of the system, they're actually starting to run into some of these same problems now. But anyway, let's carry on.
Современные техники позволят сжать эту стопу прескурантов, допустим, вот до нескольких книг или дискет, которые предприятия могли бы располагать у себя на рабочих местах. Одну секунду, извините. Да, сейчас. Хорошо. Я прошу прощения, по срочным делам меня требуют к себе министр.
Советский народ построил социализм, осуществил грандиозные преобразования в экономической, политической, государственной жизни страны и вышел на широкую дорогу.
Despite his optimism, Khrushchev's attempts to reform the planning system failed. Taking power away from Gosplan and creating regional plans only added to the complexity.
Hmm. You see, I've thought long and hard about this, and I actually do believe that you could have a more rationally planned society if you reduce things down to a level of simplicity, i.e. stripping out the level of complexity, right, in the society. But that would entail a dramatic decrease in what people call quality of life, right? You wouldn't have, in the rationally planned society that I've got in mind, you wouldn't have so many of the all mod cons. You know, it would resemble something a lot closer to a feudal medieval village. But people would be happy. You'd own nothing and you'd be happy, friends. Dunbar's number, remember that. Don't worry, it's never going to happen.
One senior scientist, academician Glushkov, predicted that by 1980, the entire Soviet population would be employed in administering the plan. The solution, he said, was the new science of rational control from America, cybernetics.
Cybernetics is a young branch of science which has a tremendous future. Here is what director of the Institute of Cybernetics, academician Viktor Glushkov, says. Cybernetics occupies a central place in the developing scientific and technological revolution. What I have in mind is the use of computers in planning the future, in forecasting scientific and technological progress.
Економіка страны Советов по нашему анализу находилась в кризисном состоянии. И нам нужно было все вместе сидеть ночи просиживать, чтобы придумать такие модели, которые позволили бы народу.
See, all of you are going crazy about my idea and saying it's 15-minute cities. You imagine a little village, 150 people, you know, living in this little place. You all know each other. You know, there's the milkman and the baker and the butcher and all of that. Like a little, you know, little, and all of this stuff, they'd never see. They'd never be privy to it. Almost like they were living in like a little doll village simulation of Trumpton. And they'd be happy in that little space. You see, it's due to your boominess that you're thinking, oh no, I wouldn't like it. But that is exactly the thesis of Pleasantville, that film, where everybody's bored in that town and they need to break out and so on and so forth. In my conception, you could actually kind of create a situation where people have like most of their basic needs for community and for happiness and religion and everything fulfilled. But they'd live a relatively simple life. You wouldn't need the Netflix and the mobile phones, and you know they wouldn't need to concern themselves with all of this. And the equivalent of this guy here, he'd be far away. You'd never see him. Just be behind the scenes, like making sure that the supply of milk was all right for the milkman and so on and so forth. All right, let's carry on.
Повысить экономическую эффективность и на этой почве повысить производительность общественного труда, а на этой почве повысить благосостояние людей. Мы пытались и все от нас зависящее делали, чтобы для решения этих проблем ввести большую экономическую науку. Большую, не подделками заниматься, а большую экономическую науку.
Into this computer, the planners fed all the information they could find about Soviet society.
You see, everybody's thinking about my imaginary Dunbar's dystopia here, right? But in the village, they would believe that the ruler was a king. They wouldn't see all of this. That would be hidden from view. They'd never see it. They never have to think about it because they're living in the Shire. And they would believe that the ruler was a king. You'd basically just simulate old-fashioned feudalism. They just wouldn't, and they'd never know, and they'd never care, and they'd be happy. See, I'm so based. I've read the Moldberg and all that, but when you're faced with it, you're terrified. You want your Deliveroo and your Netflix, don't you? All right, let's carry on.
For a brief moment in the mid-60s, it revitalized the hope that science could control society in a rational way.
И некоторые из этих людей действительно питали иллюзии, не зная хозяйства, иллюзии, что можно с помощью электронных машин все планировать, все предсказывать и так далее. Но Это была утопия.
See, you have to understand what I'm saying, though. The reason they would have to be small scale on the way I'm saying is because all of those little villages would have perfectly predictable, evenly rotating economies. You know it's only 150 people. You know that they all need this amount of milk, this amount of meat, so on and so forth. You know, and basically like a train set that goes round and round and round. Nothing ever changes. It's just something that Spengler talks about. You know, the world of the peasant is just the same. Nothing ever changes, just evenly rotating. You're all terrified, aren't you? Don't worry, it's never going to happen. You're going to live in Tony Blair world. So there we are.
Пока это еще сказать, что полностью получилось, я не скажу. Начинает получаться, начинается набирать темпы. Но пока еще не все реализовано то, что предложено наукой.
Почему?
Потому что надо, чтобы те, которые реализуют это, надо, чтобы понимали в науке и овладели ее основами.
The attempt to use computers on such a vast scale could not save the plan, or Nikita Khrushchev. In 1964, he was replaced by Brezhnev and Kosygin. They were convinced that there were rational scientific solutions that could still lead Russia to the promised land. The country's new leaders realized that although the economy was still growing and living conditions still improving, the plan was badly out of control.
No, we're not suddenly back in Moscow. These people are all Siberians. Workers in a large aircraft factory, metal workers, turners, toolmakers, designers and engineers.
The problem was the complexity of modern life, the intricacy of people's demands. The solution, the planners believed, was to find a scientific way of predicting what their people wanted.
You see, if they didn't have the idea of progress, they could have been like, okay, the problem we're running into is complexity, so let's simplify it. Let's simplify it down. Just like kind of, you know, but they were utopians. They weren't going to think that way.
Ну, я не знаю, товарищи, наверное, меня дополнят. Я думаю, что при плановой экономике прогнозировать спрос и труднее, и легче.
Проиллюстрировать на той ситуации, которая у нас сейчас сложилась с обеспечением женщин колготками, к примеру. Значит, проще прогнозировать, потому что есть определенные факторы, которые определяют развитие спроса. Мы его знаем. Значит, надо было предусматривать, рассчитывая на численность этих женщин, рассчитывая определенные сроки носки, сколько пар в год надо. Можно примерно прикинуть эту потребность и спрос на себя.
These young people are looking in a two-way mirror.
But you see, this is exactly what Mises is talking about. Let's just pretend this guy makes a perfect plan of the total number of pantyhose wanted by these women, okay? In a month's time, or 6 months' time, or a year's time, the fashion and the tastes for wearing pantyhose has probably changed. And now those women don't want pantyhose anymore. They want something else, you know, tights or whatever. So it's kind of it's a fool's errand, because you're constantly playing catch up, whereas if you have the price signals in a capitalistic society, you don't run into all of this constant headache. You'll get firms responding to supply and demand in theory. That's how it used to work in the West as well. As I say, we're running into some of these problems now as well, because people who think they're clever are always drawn to these kind of rationalistic plans,
Один из источников информации, так называемая сеть торговых корреспондентов, специальные наблюдатели, которые ведут наблюдение за состоянием торговли. В каждом городе по 2 наблюдателя. И ежемесячно сообщают нам сюда. Мы эту информацию обрабатываем на компьютерах. Вот примерно в таком вот виде оно. Эта информация
примерно... This is my pantyhose plan. It's just fucking mental. Here's my pantyhose plan. She's thinking... Is she thinking, is that going to work? Or is she thinking, this guy is completely fucking insane? But that's what people do now. They just think, oh, you know, we've got the data. My AI, my algorithmic model. It can, you know, it's all the same stuff, really. It's more sophisticated, but it's the same bullshit. Anyway, let's carry on.
В таком виде, но по существу мы знаем, как обстоят дела в торговле всеми товарами, всеми основными товарами народного потребления. Есть еще и дополнительные специфические источники информации. Панели потребителей, специально обследуем
население. Промышленность прислушивается иногда нашим научно обоснованным прогнозам, но, к сожалению, чаще всего реагирует очень медленно. Ну, например, в свое время была проблема с производством обуви на толстой подметке, на платформе. Наша промышленность начала в должном количестве выпускать эту обувь только тогда, когда она уже вышла.
So, I mean, these are all the things that, I mean, when I say Mises, he wrote that essay in 1920. So he predicted all of this would happen before communism was even a thing. So anyway, it's still hilarious, though, isn't it? We decided that people wanted platform shoes.
Мне кажется, у советского потребителя есть уже определенная установка. Когда отечественная промышленность начинает выпускать какой-то товар в достаточном количестве, значит, он перестал быть модным.
You see, I mean, just to play devil's advocate a bit, this is, I think, one of the reasons why you're starting to see this stupidity is because Khrushchev fancied himself as a progressive, right? And you know, the leadership of the Soviet Union was like, you know, oh, we're not going to do it like Stalin anymore. Stalin would have said, listen, you're fucking having platforms, all right? Don't think you've got a choice about it. You're having platforms. This is the USSR, and in this country, we wear platforms. And if you've got a problem with that, you can get to the gulag. And that's why the system worked better when it was under Stalin, because he, you know, they didn't have, like, he didn't have stupid notion that people were free and all this sort of bullshit. So anyway, let's carry on. I mean, of course, Stalin being Stalin would never have said you're having platforms, because he would have thought they were stupid. He would have been like, no, here's your standard issue Stalin Soviet Union shoe. You're having that shoe. Don't complain.
А вот с конца 60-х годов началась самая страшная эпоха послевоенного периода. Это то, что мы называем эпоха застоя, которая переросла в кризис 78-го года. У нас началось падение сельскохозяйственного производства, стагнации промышленности, падение уровня.
Here's your standard issue, Stalin thong. You get that one thong, those pantyhose, those tights. Better get used to it, because these are the pantyhose, thongs and tights that you Russian women are going to wear for the next 10 years. That is my decree. Argue with me, bullet in the head. And you can see that, you see, this is the symbiotic relationship between the USSR and USA. You can see the USSR always had in mind like American fashions, or they were trying to compete with America, so on. Oh, they, you know, they like going to disco or whatever. Our women have to do that. So part of the reason it's all falling apart is because they kind of lost their authoritarianism, I argue, I would say.
Жизнь. Вот. Это был ужасный период. ужасный период, когда производство стало развиваться ради производства. И мы свои позиции 60-х годов...
By the mid-70s, the Soviet leadership gave up attempting to reform the plan. As the economy finally began to slow down, much of industry degenerated into pointless, elaborate ritual. What had begun as a grand, moral attempt to build a rational society ended by creating a bizarre, bewildering existence for millions of Soviet people.
Tell you what, though, she wasn't short on those potatoes, was she, that girl? We always say, oh, you know, they were running out of food and they had to... I mean, she was not short of meat and veg, was she?
There's the Pacific, the quiet ocean, the roar of which never dies down. Somewhere beyond the horizon, there are the 1980s. New destinies and new songs.
Пусть голова моя седа, зимы мне нечего пугаться. Не только грусть, мои года, мое богатство. Пусть голова моя седа, не только грусть, мои года, мое богатство.
Конечно, встает вопрос, почему же нам не удалось сделать то, о чем мы мечтали? Построить такое общество, которое дало бы человеку полный простор в развитии его духовных начал, его культуры, благосостояния. Кто виноват? Винить надо не науку, винить надо людей, которые...
Roosevelt and De Gaulle in Allies at War.
And that's it. All right. Well, fantastic first episode of Pandora's Box. Next week, we're going to go on to episode 2, and I'm going to have Luke, aka Lambda, on, because we're going to be looking at game theory and things like that, which he is into, being a tech nerd, as well as a holy man, of course. Let's have a little look at some super chats. There's been a few, and then we will. Then we will sign off for the week. First super chat is from Lewis Shaw Moffat, who says, I don't have the dreams for the future of tomorrow. I'm too fascinated with that of the mythical future and past. Interesting. I mean, I do think that it's important to have some sort of, for a society, I mean, to have some sort of vision of the future. And one of the problems that we have in the West at the moment is that, in a way, everybody is too, like, backwards focused. And, I mean, this is something that Biden was talked about with his futurism and his modernism and so on. And, it does have a tremendous power. It does have a tremendous power in and of itself. The point I was making with the negative and positive vision stuff is that really that has to come afterwards, after you've actually got power. Otherwise, it's just point. Otherwise, you're just kind of daydreaming in a way. You have to achieve the power first. And in order to do that, you have to get rid of the fuckers who were there already, which we are nowhere even close to doing. Coney says, do you remember the guy from the capitalism versus communism debate who thought that AI could overcome the knowledge problem in centrally planned economies? Yeah, I remember that guy. He was a young chap, and he actually had a Dell computer. And I remember during that debate, this was back when I focused more on economics, and it was one of my first appearances. It was on Sargon's channel. It was on Sargon's main channel. Probably the largest audience I've ever streamed to, because it was a absolutely massive event, that was. And I just remember I talked about corn, and all the corn was, all I could see was like massive blocks of people posting corn, because I kept on talking about corn. But anyway, there was a moment during that debate where he pulled out a Dell computer and said, I could program the entire economy on this Dell. And it became a meme for a while. That was in the very early days of this channel. This is like early, like late 2016, early 2017 sort of time. So it's coming up to 8 years ago now. Swingfire 2000 says, has Morkar play Workers and Resources, Soviet Republic, the socialist city builder game? You have to do everything down to planning vehicle routes. That has been a game on my wish list for a very long time, but it's always a bit too expensive. I'm always loath to pay anything above £20 for a game, and it's always just in and around the kind of wrong price point. I may have actually bought it on sale at Christmas, but I've never played it. Lewis Shaw Moffat says, some people have to be the miners and farmers, the peasantry. It's okay. You can still be great. You can still be great men to your peasant families, and that is good enough. Yeah, absolutely, of course. But the point I'm making is that I think that there's a lot of people who don't want more than that. I think in the liberal imagination, you always think of those people as being oppressed and as wanting to break out of it. But this is a delusion. The vast majority of people want to be told what to do, and they want to be returned to being peasantry. They don't want the freedom, because freedom is anxiety inducing. Having to think about what job you do is anxiety inducing. This is why we have record rates of suicide and unhappiness and all sorts of mental conditions, because people who are effectively peasants are being forced into doing complex cognitive roles in a post-industrial society. And they would be much happier if they would go back to being peasants, in my opinion. Now, not most people, including most of you, are not going to want to hear that, but it's true. And if COVID taught you nothing else, it should have taught you that. The Enriab says, AA, have you listened to Dan's recent Brokenomics, Life After a Dollar Collapse? It's a book review, a discussion of the mandibles. It addresses the Paul Krugman types. I highly recommend it. I haven't had a chance to watch that yet. Maybe I'll check it out soon. Well, the thing is, Robert, is that you'll never get people to acquiesce to that idea. When you say it's a hard sell, you're never going to get people saying, I want that. But ultimately, a benevolent rulership does what a people needs, not what a people wants. And ultimately, that is what a people need. The vast majority of the public it's shown they don't respond well to living these advanced modern societies. It's kind of literally soul destroying for most of them. So, you know, anyway, there's no point discussing it, because it's never going to happen. Let's face it. It's never going to happen. So, you know, the closest thing that the thing that it would take to achieve that is like a Mad Max kind of scenario. You know, then you'd essentially get an organic reproduction of feudalism, something like that. Louis Shaw Moffat says, AA, are you getting Rurik Skywalker on in the future? I have no plans to get Rurik Skywalker on. QWERTY 7 says, how do his views differ from Sol's? QWERTY, whose views? Whose views do you have in mind from Sol's? And you see, look, I mean, Eccentric Tripper says AA wants us to be his slaves. That is, again, a very kind of boomer reaction to what I'm saying, that doesn't is not really comprehending the meat of what I'm saying. But that is basically how 99.9% of people will process what I'm saying, because that is the power of liberalism and the power of boomer truth. That is because Eccentric Tripper has not killed the liberal within himself. He does not desire an ordered hierarchical society where people want to be part of something bigger than themselves. He is happy being an atomized individual who has my freedom. His views are essentially the same views as John Lennon or as Tony Blair. Essentially, Eccentric Tripper already has the leaders he wants. And I think that more people than would care to admit already live under the system and the leadership they want, which is why we continue to have the leaders that we do. I think Carlyle says everybody has the leaders they deserve, ultimately. And here we are. Ultimately, you want it. You want the wealth. You want the Walmart and the McDonald's and the drive-through and the Deliveroo and the Netflix and all the rest of it. You want it. And there's no, you know, what else can I say? That is the case. Angelo Eddy says, if America focuses on China after Trump wins, will there be a chance of minor conflict or just a series of nothing burgers? And I think it'll be a Cold War type scenario. It's hard to know what will happen there. Cairo Scuro says, thanks for the excellent stream and insights. Well, thank you very much, Cairo Scuro. It means so much. So Quirty saying, I guess I mean, how do the views of the USSR economy expressed in this stream differ from Thomas Sowell's? Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, Thomas Sowell was a Hayekian, essentially. I mean, he's always called a Chicago school economist, but his thinking is really very strongly influenced by Hayek and the knowledge problem. Sowell has a book called Knowledge and Decisions, which is basically a book-length exposition on the Hayekian knowledge problem. So, the critique of the USSR economy is basically the same as Sowell's, but Sowell was right about that. Now, that is not to say that, therefore return to Reaganism or anything like that, because there are other issues, as I've been outlining. There are other critiques of the capitalistic, I mean, both capitalism and socialism start with the premise that the goal of life is the maximization of material output. But through all of our reading and our thinking, we don't believe, or I don't believe, that the goal of a society should be to maximize output in that way. People ultimately want to be part of something bigger than themselves, and they want to believe in something, and they want to be part of a community of real relationships, real people. And a society that is only materialistic leaves them spiritually malnourished, and it leaves them ultimately with a whole host of increasingly bizarre mental conditions. And, you know, ultimately it doesn't fulfill the basic, it doesn't fulfill many of the things that people yearn for in their hearts. So what it does fulfill extremely well is comfort and material needs and food, things like that. And I guess the central problem is, once you're in a post-industrial society like we are in now, how do you reverse engineer some of those bad things that have happened? Everybody kind of triggers about the WEF and the 15-minute cities and they don't want to depopulate us and so on. But ultimately, to the extent, I mean, I've never actually seen any proof that the WEF want to do half of this stuff. I've never seen proof that the WEF want to depopulate, for example. But ultimately, I do think that we should depopulate, and we should aim for more simple, less complex societies that foreground some of these other things that I'm talking about, that is not constantly growth oriented. And that is really something that the West and the entire world is going to have to wean itself off this whole mindset of growth, growth, growth all the time. Because it leads to ultimately a society which is dysgenic and harmful and soul destroying. That's why so many people have become quote unquote dissidents in my analysis. However, because of the ingrained power of Boomer Truth, you will always get the liberal within rebelling against everything I'm telling you, because it's the whole life that you've led and the waters that you've swam in. So you're not going to, you're going to naturally bulk at some of these more kind of hardcore reactionary sentiments from Carlyle and Avila and other people that I'm giving you here. All right. But don't worry, because it's not going to happen. You're going to live in Tony Blair world, not in the world that I'm outlining. Robert Simpson says, can you use the Bezmenov model to achieve AA utopia? Well, I mean, I think that my AA utopia would only work really if you started with people who'd never lived in our world now. I think most of you couldn't live in the world that I wanted, in the kind of little villages and things that I would want to try to create, because you'd miss your iPhone too much, frankly. You'd miss all the mod cons. You'd miss all of the... And I don't think those two things are compatible, you see. I think that you can't at once have the things that led to the ashes, right? What we call the ashes of civilization. You can't have those things in any new society that's devoid of them. Because ultimately I'm trying to, I mean, again, I'm not trying to create anything. This is just one of many ideas I have. But in that kind of Trumpdom vision, most people wouldn't have any of the concerns that we have now. They wouldn't be looking at their phones. There wouldn't be a news bulletin telling them what's going on halfway around the world. Their world would be a lot smaller. It would be a lot more human. It just wouldn't, you wouldn't have to care about what was happening in Chicago, for example, because it would be of none of your concern whatsoever. Your concern would be your local community, your friends, your family. You know, getting off with a girl down the back of the hay shed. And, you know, maybe this vision is rejected because it's not compelling and people actually want something closer to a kind of techno-futurist utopia that Elon Musk would have in mind or something like that, where it's transhumanist and AI and ever-increasing growth and complexity. My own view and my studies have led me to the idea that I don't think people in their heart of hearts want that, and they actually yearn for something closer to what I am outlining. The trouble is that we live in a society that habituates you to lots of addictions. Addictions to social media, addictions to porn, addictions to, you know, eating fast food, addictions to watching shit television. Or in some cases, addictions to drugs and alcohol and so on and so forth. And I believe that most people watching this stream and indeed living in the West today couldn't actually live in the society that I'm outlining. They'd go mad. I think they'd miss all of the things that they used to. And I'm not sure I could deal with it either. I mean, I sometimes have experiments where I try to, like, you know, not touch Twitter or whatever. It's difficult. This is something I've talked to Morgoth about. Morgoth will go on 7-hour hikes and things, or not look at the news for 5 days and things like that. I can't do that. He's got better self-control than I have. But ultimately, we need to, you know, I'm trying to envisage a world where your head is not filled with the media and all of the bullshit concerns of the world all the time. But it's impossible to get to. This is why I keep on telling you that the child of the children of the winter can't be the children of the spring. All right. That'll do for now. I will see you next week. Do buy my courses, especially Foundations of Economics, if you were interested in, because I talk about many of these issues we looked at in this stream in Foundations of Economics, but also pick up the Trivium and all the other courses. And I'll see you next Monday, friends. Now get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.